there you are, my dear friend. Come in. Come in out of the cold and warm yourself by the fire. I was just perusing the volumes on the dusty old shelves of this library for something to read before retiring. Who do we have? Blackwood? James? Lovecraft? Poe? Quite the collection. Would you care to hear something? You would? Splendid. Now, let me see. Ah, here we are. I believe I have the very thing.
Devo Nodenti by Kerris MacDonald. Peggy awakes as usual with Eustace squatting on her chest. For a moment, the panic of her tangled dreams. Laurel had tried to phone, but she hadn't picked up in time. She was trying to ring back, but she kept getting the telephone number wrong, her fingers stabbing the keys over and over. Back to the start, do it again, 780. For a moment, that panic stays with her. She can't breathe. She looks up into Eustace's non-face, looming down over hers as if he's trying to kiss her, and she can't raise her hands to fend him off or even draw breath enough to scream. No, no, relax. Just give it a second. Hands first. Her fingers, which have been pinned to the sheets by paralysis until now, wake at last and twitch. They're always the first. Then a heave of her ribcage. She sucks in breath. Eustace tilts his head, black horns silhouetted against the pale bedroom ceiling. One might, if one chooses, read a disappointment into that motion. His faceless face withdraws.
"Get off me,"
Peggy whispers. Deferential as ever, he flips backward off her torso and hangs upside down in the corner of the room like a gigantic bat, his long, boneless fingers and toes clutching the plaster cornice. He's much lighter than his black and rubbery bulk might suggest, as she knows only too well. He never crushes her chest when he sits on her, after all, though she does ache all over now as she sits up, just like she aches every morning. The bedsheets are soaked with sweat. She sleeps naked, despite her respectable age, just because she hates the feeling of a clammy nightie clinging to her. Peggy gets up slowly, finds her slippers and dressing gown, then pulls all the bedding back to give it a chance to air. Eustace flicks out his long, wickedly barbed tail and begins to trace the tip along the many grooves and lines in his skin. She'd call it preening, if he were a bird. His oil-black form looks like it's been skinned to reveal the intricate musculature, or maybe built from chopped-up car tires. Yes, she saw an exhibition of tire art once, and it made her nod sourly with recognition. "I expect you had a good night," Peggy mutters as she tries to straighten her back. "Ate well, I'm guessing? Well, I'm glad at least one of us enjoyed it." Eustace doesn't answer, of course. He has no mouth to speak with, no facial features at all. Peggy decided years ago that what he sustains himself on is delta waves. That's why she never gets any proper sleep, the deep, dreamless, healing sleep she craves. All she's known for decades is the riotous circus of REM. Frustration dreams, confused memories, nightmares, circular OCD repetitions. She almost always wakes feeling completely worn out. Right now, her eyes are as dry as if she's spent the night staring into the darkness. Moving stiffly to the window, she's still too young to hobble, damn it. She pulls back the curtains and lets light spill into the bedroom. Outside, the September morning is bright and sunny. Yellow leaves splotch her tiny patch of front lawn. She'll rake them up today, she tells herself, if the arthritis in her hands is cooperative. When she turns back into the room, there's no sign of Eustace. He's never seen in direct daylight, and for many years, Peggy thought that sunlight drove him away. Now, though, she's come to suspect that he's still there, always there, just not visible. He is, after all, more in her head than anywhere else. As she stands in the shower, with her eyes closed against the flow and the prick of shampoo, Peggy can see Eustace quite clearly in her mind's eye, lying couchant on the pink bathroom mat. He, well, it, He has sex organs no more than he has a face, but Peggy has given him a name, and with the name has come some sort of spurious gender. Even resembles a great dog sometimes, if he tilts his head back to disguise the curve of his horns against his bulk, and he moves on all fours, as is his preference. His body is so dark and gnarled and cartilaginous that it's hard to make out his true outline. Only when he unfurls his wings do you realize that what you'd taken for a muscular, hunched back was nothing but membranous skin, and see for the first time how skeletal he is, how barbed and demonic. She'd had some vague idea that a name might help make him less horrible, or at least more bearable. Is that so weird? Some people give their tumours names, she's heard. It's easier if she thinks of him as a dog, a big, silent dog that follows her around from room to room. Faithful, in his way. Cave Canem, she thinks, remembering the black and white photograph of the little statuette of the hound on the cover of the paper she'd held out 50 years ago to Rory D'Angelo.
"What the hell is this?" she asked.
"Oh, you've got a copy?" He smiled as he glanced at the title under the university's coat of arms. "Report on the second excavation of the prehistoric Roman and post-Roman site in Lydney Park, Gloucestershire." That title was a direct nod to the original Wheeler excavation report of 1932, a little archaeological joke.
"It looks splendid, doesn't it? The Society of Antiquaries are printing a précis next month."
"It looks splendid for you, Rory. Where the hell's my name in it? I've read every damn word and I don't get a mention."
He cocked an eyebrow, bemused.
"Well, I did write the paper. Of course I'm the one credited."
His silver hair managed to be perfectly coiffed even in the midst of a wet dig on a hill overlooking the River Severn.
"Huh? I was the one who sat up at night and typed up every note. Yes, you put in a great deal of the legwork. I'm very grateful. I was the one who found the votive statue."
She flicked the photograph with nails that had dark rinds of dirt ingrained so deep under them that no amount of hand-washing under the cold tap of the community hall would ever get it out.
"I was the one who first suggested to you that we were looking at a bloody temple abaton."
She was trying to keep the rage out of her voice, but it wasn't working.
"Why don't I get credit?"
"Peggy, darling, you will."
He looked pained by what was clearly a childish display of temper. He'd never liked displays of emotion, after all.
"All in good time. You're only 21, and I'm sure you have a splendid career ahead of you, but let's face facts. Who's going to take any notice of a girl postgrad trying to suggest the existence of a hitherto unsuspected cultic practice here in Britain? You need my name, my experience, my gravitas. I need the credit for my work and my ideas."
"Don't worry, I'll put in an excellent word for you for your next position. I'm on your side, Peggy, and you need that in this field."
"You..."
Her mouth flapped. "I think you forget how competitive archaeology is as a study, and how important word of mouth is in establishing your reputation. There are so many bright-eyed young girl archaeologists out there just desperate for the chances you've been offered. The recommendation of your professor is gold dust at this stage, Peggy." He smiled benignly.
"Now let's not quarrel over trivial matters. There's so much work that's still to be done. We only have a week left on this dig, remember?"
Brushing a little dust off his knee, he rose and strolled out of the hut. Somehow he always looked immaculate, even when wearing overalls, even when everyone around him was covered in mud. Peggy, hardly remembering to breathe, watched him stroll across to the principal trench in the central shrine, where the undergrads were on their knees scraping the mud with trowels. The watery sunlight turned his silver hair to a halo. She watched Alice, a first-year student, look up as Professor D'Angelo paused to squat at the lip of the trench and talk to her. She held up a tray of her finds. Peggy knew exactly what sort of thing was being found here. Romano British pottery and coins, bronze pins, maybe a little lead petition scroll begging the aid of the local god Nodens. And the look of pleasure on Alice's young and eager face as she gazed up at the handsome older man was visible even from here. In the shower, Peggy opens her eyes.
"Damn him! That creepy, cradle-snatching bastard! That thieving son of a bitch!"
No, she hasn't forgiven. Not even after all these years. If she forgives him, she'll have to accept the guilt that she's held off at arm's length for 5 decades. Wrapping herself in a towel, she sits upon the toilet lid to comb out her wet hair and muster her strength. Everything takes so long these days, even getting dressed. Between her arthritis and her exhaustion, each step in the process is a hurdle to be clambered. What she really wants to do is make a cup of tea and go back to bed for the day, but she can't let herself off that easily. Nigel is due to visit later on with wife and children in tow, so she has to be ready. She enjoys seeing her only grandson, though she can't find quite the same enthusiasm for the 3 children, each of whom takes it in turn to be variously sulky, hyperactive, and riddled with germs. At her age, the prospect of catching even a cold is daunting. Searching for her vitamin C tablets, Peggy pauses with the bathroom cabinet open, looking at the bottles of pills within, stockpiled from decades when Valium and sleeping tablets were handed out like sweeties. Not that they've ever brought her the true unconsciousness and rest she craves, just longer nights of seething, frantic visions. She picks up a brown glass bottle and shakes it gently, listening to the rattle within. Easy, she thinks. It would be so easy. But in that sleep of death, what dreams may come, she quotes out loud. Aye, there's the rub. Isn't that right, Eustace? At the corner of her vision, Eustace twists his boneless neck quizzically to invert his head altogether. He's companionship of a sort, she tells herself, and isn't that something? At least he responds to her voice, and sometimes she can convince herself that he understands the words. Plenty of people her age are all on their own, with only memories for company. Too wound up to sleep that night 50 years ago, she wandered out among the low walls of the Lydney Park excavation, while everyone else went back to their ex-army cots in the village hall. The stars were muted behind high and hazy cloud, but the moon was full enough to cast black shadows from the trench walls. All was silent. In the valley below the bluff, the broad slick of the Severn was a pale wedge driven like a spearhead into Britain's guts. Back in the 4th century, she brooded, when the stone temple was built over the old mines to replace whatever rustic fane had served the native Britons, this must have been a magical place. The uncanny wave of the Severn bore had processed up the face of the river 2 times a day. The earth had yielded iron ore, an extraordinary treasure wrestled out of those dangerous low tunnels. The old gods had still lurked in the woods, and joined with the new Roman deities to create strange hybrids. No dens now, he was among the strangest. Archaeologists couldn't agree even now what he'd been a god of. The Romans identified him with Mars, with Neptune, with Sylvanus, with Mercury, which suggested everything from warfare to sailing, forestry to the afterlife. 19th-century scholars had glossed his name as Lord of the Deeps or Lord of the Abyss. A young Professor Tolkien, yes, that one, had analysed it and suggested he was cognate with the later Irish god-hero Nuada of the Silver Hand and the Welsh Nith, and that it meant snarer, catcher, or hunter. The hard archaeological evidence hinted at an oceanic nature, but also at a strong connection with dogs, which might mean hunting or might mean healing, given the symbolism of the time. A curse tablet found here in the 1880s had aimed at bringing back and avenging a stolen gold ring. And that long row of little cells right there at the back of the main temple, that was the building Peggy had identified with the famous abaton of the medicine god Asclepius. A place for patients or petitioners to be put into a drugged sleep, enchymesis, for the purpose of incubating a visionary encounter with their god. Peggy wished bitterly then that she could have a dream that would lay out the solution to all her problems. "Bastard," she said under her breath, sitting down on a low wall and leaning back against a stone. It felt cold through her canvas trousers, but she didn't care. She'd had a pint of Guinness at the pub, all she could stomach of both the fluid and the company of her fellow diggers, and now she felt heavy-legged and queasy. Tears burned the backs of her eyes. Her anger was a hot stone buried under her ribs. If she'd had a sheet of lead, and any faith at all in dead gods, she could have quite happily cursed D'Angelo. Devo Nodenti. Silvianus anilum perdedit de mediam partem donavit nodenti. Inter quibus nomen Seniciani nolis pet mitas sanitatem donec perferat usque templum nodentis. She rattled off under her breath. She knew the inscription by heart. Looking up at the blurred stars, she mulled over the incontrovertible truth that neither Silvianus's loss nor hers mattered a jot to them. Sitting in her kitchen with a slice of buttered toast and the mug of tea she's been longing for since waking, Peggy catches herself wondering why these memories are coming back to her today. It must be something she dreamt about last night, she thinks, something about the dig, so that all the old scab is picked off and the raw memories exposed to the air again. It's not as if they are ever far from her consciousness. Eustace is an ever-present reminder of that night in 1965 and all it led to. But she does try not to brood. What good does it do, after all? She made her bargain, and she's paid the price ever since. As if hearing his name spoken, Eustace drops down from the central light fitting he's been clinging to, and crawls across the floor to settle in the shadows under the kitchen table. If she moves her foot slightly, she could touch him, she realizes, and she wonders what that would feel like. She feels his weight on her chest nightly, but has never voluntarily touched that skin. It's slightly sheened, as if oily, and she imagines he'll feel cold. He's a creature of the underworld, after all. He even smells like a damp coal bunker. She looked up suddenly among the ruins of Lydney Temple, as if startled, though she'd seen nothing, heard nothing. And there, in front of her, set in the grass, was a door. There had never been any question that she was still awake. Obviously she was dreaming. She recognised the door. It belonged in the street next to her parents' End Terrace house in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Every other house in that steep street had a backyard with a coal bunker next to the outside toilet, both built of brick. Theirs, however, had a hatch in the street covered by heavy wooden doors that allowed the coal man to drop the coal straight down into their cellar. Hadar thought that maybe their place had once been a pub, and probably this was the delivery entrance for beer barrels. If so, it had come down in the world, because they kept their coal down there now, and no beer. Peggy had always been nervous of that cellar as a child, a filthy place her ma hated her brothers and her playing in, and positively scared of the hatch, which she always felt might give way under her feet and drop her into the darkness. Of course, that meant she had to try standing on it every day after school. Now that hatch, she recognised the vestiges of faded green paint, stood there hundreds of miles from home in a Roman ruin on a hilltop in the West Country, one leaf open and leaning back. A faint glow shone up from within. It looked like an invitation. Rising, she approached the drop. Not a coal hole, as she'd anticipated. No, the open door revealed a spiral staircase of polished wood descending vertically into the earth. The walls of the shaft were covered in shelves full of books, and on the first step sat a lamp, an old-style miner's lamp, like her dad used to use when she was little. That was the main source of the illumination, though there was a faint shine on the shelf edges that suggested a glow from far below. Picking up the lamp, Peggy began her descent. The staircase coiled round, lapping itself, her footfalls clunking on the wooden treads. She glanced at the books, thinking that they seemed familiar. She saw bright modern paperbacks, the kind she liked to read on the train, and bound copies of archaeological journals such as she consulted in the university department. Then a set of worn Dickens hardbacks like her ma kept in the front parlour. No, not like. Identical to. Even down to the torn cloth spine on A Christmas Carol that was her fault. Although she couldn't actually read the faded lettering on the spines, it seemed all mixed up somehow. A Margaret Murray she recalled borrowing from the local library. Yes, lots of library books with inked shelf numbers. And now, further down, 50 steps down, children's books she had long forgotten, but which now stood out like the faces of old friends in a crowd. She recognised the pictures on the covers even though the letters danced out of focus. Alice in Wonderland, of course. What could be more appropriate? Enid Blyton, the Princess and the Goblin, a rare, treasured, golden-era Perrault's fairy tales that her ma had read to her at night. Peggy pulled this last one out of its shelf and tried to flick through, but although the colour plates were there just as she remembered, the text was blurred beyond legibility. Of course, she told herself, you can't ever read in dreams. She replaced it carefully in its slot, because the blackness at the back of the shelf and the cold draught blowing out of that hole was oddly unnerving. Then she took the last turn of the stairs, and that warm glow that had been growing all through her descent, rendering the lamp more and more unnecessary, made her blink. 70, she said to herself, not even sure why she'd been counting. She was standing in a broad cavern with walls of rough-hewn rock and a floor of marble so highly polished that for a moment she thought it was glass. In the centre of the floor was a wellhead, from which a column of flame rose, twisting like a tornado. The fire flickered from red to yellow to violet as it burned, and it took a few seconds for her eyes to adjust. From either side behind the flame stepped two tall men. They were dressed in tunics of white linen with broad pectoral collars of blue beads. Both sported long, stiff beards dyed blue, both had their heads shaved bald, and their eyes heavily outlined in kohl. Peggy had never seen men wearing eyeliner before, at least not outside a historical illustration, and she found either their makeup or something else about them deeply disconcerting. Egyptian, she guessed, or Roman, she couldn't tell. Romano-Egyptian priests. What is this?
Peggy Ann Connings, said the first man, looking her up and down as she frowned. What are you doing here, child? Asked the second.
I don't know, she muttered. She'd spotted what it was about them that she didn't like. The column of flame threw their shadows up the walls of the cavern, making them dance and loom. But the heads of those shadows did not match the heads that cast them. They weren't shaven. They weren't even human.
What did you come here for?
She bit her lip, trying not to stare at the shadows. His black eyes bored into hers, and he was so close now that she could see herself reflected in them. That silly little backstreet girl with her grammar school education and her scholarship grant and her fake aspirational accent. The girl who'd let herself be charmed and used and then dropped like an empty chip paper. The girl who'd reached out for the ladder up and found it snatched from her reach.
Justice, she said, licking her dry lips. I came here for justice.
Just us, Nigel cries merrily as he opens the front door. Hello, Gran. Peggy happily accepts their greetings as the kids push into the house and run round checking out the dusty collection of weird stuff. Malaysian masks, Burmese puppets, anthropomorphic Peruvian pots. That makes visiting the old lady bearable. Nigel looks jolly, and Andrea looks mildly harassed as ever. For years Peggy thought he'd never marry. It wasn't good for a boy to be brought up by his grandmother, no matter how hard she tried, she'd berated herself. But he somehow pulled it off at the final moment. He seems to thrive on fatherhood, she is relieved to see. She has no worries about anyone spotting Eustace. He's only a figment of her imagination, after all, so they never notice him. As they all settle down for a drink and a chat, he drapes himself across the top of the big dresser as if watching with his non-eyes. His long and wickedly spined tail hangs down like a cat's, twitching gently. After a cup of tea, Nigel loads Peggy and the children into the car and takes them out to the shops, while Andrea stays behind to give the house a bit of a clean, an arrangement that suits everyone. Gaps in the buildings give them glimpses as they drive on the Clifton suspension bridge over the Avon Gorge, and the brick towers and graceful Victorian span catch the children's attention.
What's that? What's that? Can we drive over it, Dad?
No, says Nigel firmly, casting Peggy a worried look.
She told me she could fly. In her dreams, Peggy murmurs.
They spend an hour looking at home furnishings and toys in the big warehouse store, where Peggy buys birthday cards and a new washing-up bowl.
Then they eat lunch in a burger bar chosen by the children, much to Nigel's embarrassment.
It's fine, Nigel dear, don't worry,
Peggy reassures him for at least the third time.
I don't mind where we eat.
It isn't like she has much appetite these days, anyway. She steals a glance around the cafe, wondering if Eustace has come out with them. It's much harder to see him outside the familiar confines of home she's discovered, but he's still there.
I drawed you a picture, Granny,
announces Beau, the youngest great-grandchild, hard at work with the free kids' meal crayons.
That's lovely.
She holds the paper at arm's length, squinting at the stick figure next to the black scribble.
Who is that?
That's you, he says,
and that's your doggie.
Gran doesn't have a dog, Nigel says when she doesn't answer.
My dream she had one.
You know, says Peggy, there's a theory that we are all dreaming all the time. The mind is in a constant state of visualization, even when awake, but the brain overrides these hallucinations and doesn't let the consciousness register them, unless you take LSD or are totally exhausted or something, of course. She blinks, and then realizes that everyone is staring at her, confused. The first priest lifted his painted brows and stepped back, as if this was no longer his responsibility. The second spread his hands.
Choose a door, then.
There were two tall doors on the right-hand side of the cavern. Set into the rough rock, they were themselves exquisite works of pointed Gothic art, carved and traced with abstract designs. Peggy, a little warily, walked closer. One door was made of pure white ivory, its swirling inlay all of gold. The other door was more ominous, a yellow-brown with even darker mottled patches, and its filigree inlay looked like wrought iron.
I know these.
Virgil, isn't it? The Aeneid. The gate of horn through which true dreams pass, and the gate of ivory which sends out deceptive ones. There was another gate on the far side of the cavern, but that had no door, and she could see that it was another stairway leading downward. She didn't like the look of that one at all.
This,
she said, laying her hand on the door of horn. It swung open without resistance. She was standing on a cliff edge. Whether she was still underground it was hard to tell, but the cavern roof, if it existed, was lost in a pale grey haze in which black birds flocked and wheeled. The cliff dropped away in a tangle of jagged black rocks, and washing against those rocks, far below her feet, was a grey sea of clouds. She watched the waves of vapour roll in and explode against the cliff face, sending up showers of spray that splashed against her face, with no sensation of wet at all, but dry as rice. There was a faint pattering as the spume fell back and drained from the inky stone. All around her feet the rocks were patched with silvery grit. Pearls, she realized, seed pearls flung up from the deeps by the cumulonimbus surf. Mixed among them were paler specks that turned out, when she scooped them in her hand, to be baby's teeth.
Of course,
she told herself. Nodens was no god of the ocean or the forest, not even of death, though all those things were metaphors for his domain. The great abyss was the wilderness inside our heads, the unknown and unknowable depths of the subconscious, the land of dreams and terrors and lost memories. He was god of something that had no material existence, god of nothing at all. Yet that no thing shaped us and made us and drove us. It was the place all our gods and ourselves came from. He was a tiny, insignificant god, and at exactly the same time he was Deo Maximus. After all, the things that truly mattered were those that existed only inside our heads, love and loss and pain. Everything else in the real world was just the shuffling of atoms. Another wave spat foam high, and the birds circling overhead caught her attention on the upward glance. They weren't rooks, after all, though they were just as black. Bats, perhaps? Their dusky wings looked translucent.
There were thousands of them, and they were flying closer now.
No, not bats. Legs too long and tails like whips. Demons, like in some Italian fresco depiction of the falling angels. Shuddering, Peggy spun round, and there, lowering behind her, waited Nodens. Grey was her first impression. Grey and awful. Its long hair was grey, exactly the same colour as its draping robes, and covered its face so fully that she could only guess the shape of the head beneath, and imagine the hollows of the eyes watching her. At its feet lay the carcass of a dolphin, gutted to expose its pink entrails and the silver spill of the fish that had formed its last meal. Crabs were feasting on both.
What do you want, Peggy?
Noden's voice was a whisper, a trickle of shale fragments on a barren scree slope. Then she realized that the hair, just like the silks, was nothing more than cobweb, layer upon layer of the stuff, thickly coated in dust. Those drapes were neither hair nor robes, and the true form of that hunched and shrouded figure was something she suddenly did not want to descry. For a moment she wavered, wondering whether she could flee past it to the safety of the gate, but she couldn't see the portal from this side, just a towering cliff face reaching up to the maybe sky. And she could feel the watching demons overhead. Her scalp crawled at the thought.
Professor D'Angelo, she said, clearing her throat. He's a thief and a liar, and he picks on young girls who don't know any better.
She felt that the words were coming out wrong, but she had to explain.
What do you come to ask of me?
He hurt me, so I want him hurt. She sucked her dry lips. He has to be stopped or he'll just go on and do it again.
Nodens tilted its head. There was something weird about her vision, she thought. She could not tell if the figure was human-sized and close, or further away and unspeakably vast. It seemed to change every time she tried to focus.
I will do that, if you are willing to pay the price.
What's the price?
Peace of mind.
That desiccated voice fluttered and sank, as if spoken down a tube miles off.
You will always remember what you did, and you will never sleep easy.
I can live with that, she answered, drawing herself up.
You will have to for many years. Now go home.
We should go home now, says Nigel, gathering up Beau's crayons. I promised to fix that porch light today, didn't I?
They drive back, and Nigel fixes the back porch light while the kids run around the overgrown garden.
This is really too much for you now, Gran. You should hire someone to take those shrubs out and put in a nice patio.
And Andrea hangs the laundry out. They brought along a DVD of some cartoon show Peggy doesn't recognise, which keeps the kids quiet for an hour, while Nigel replaces the batteries in the remotes and does a second load of laundry, and Andrea pops out with the car to do a supermarket shop and stock up all the cupboards. Peggy is grateful for their kindness, but exhausted. She finds herself wanting to sit in her armchair in front of an old movie, with just Eustace crouched on the rug or hanging in the corner of the room for company. The noises of life and youth are too much these days. Shrieking and squabbling voices make her head spin. Had she misheard Nodens? She sometimes wonders wryly. Had he said, peace of mind, or a piece of your mind?
I've got something to show you, Gran, Nigel tells her with a smile. He's holding out his laptop computer like a silver tray. Take a look at this.
Peggy has never bothered with owning a computer, though she does have a smartphone, which she'd been bought for Christmas and barely used.
She sits with Nigel at the kitchen table and watches with what she hopes is proper enthusiasm as he opens up browser windows. "This is Wikipedia," he tells her. "Do you know what that is?" She shakes her head. "It's an online encyclopedia. There are literally millions of articles on every subject you can imagine here, in hundreds of languages. Anyone can access it, and anyone can contribute to it. Well, sort of. You have to prove you know your stuff and cite sources and back up your arguments. But it means there's not just a handful of people telling us what we should think about a subject. There are millions of people all over the world sharing their knowledge. The Encyclopedia Britannica's dead in the water, Gran. This is the future of information sharing. Now, look at this." He clicks on a star. A new page opens, headed Lydney Park Excavations. It's divided into several subsections. The Mortimer Wheeler dig in the 1920s, the Casey et al. Excavation in 1980-81, and between them, to Peggy's alarm, a couple of paragraphs on the D'Angelo digs in 1963-5. She doesn't want to look. "Is the text big enough for you, Gran?" Nigel asks, doing something that makes the screen zoom in. She has no excuse. She scans the first few sentences, and then comes across one that makes her heart cram into her mouth. D'Angelo's postgraduate assistant, Peggy Connings, was the first to identify the range of buildings behind the temple as an incubation, Greek abaton, a place for guests seeking divinatory or healing dreams. "Oh," she says. She can feel her pulse racing. "Really?" "Yep. Everyone can see it now, Gran. Everyone in the world." "That's..." She passes her hand over her face. "My goodness, that's wonderful." "About time, eh?" He looks so pleased with himself. Peggy's gaze slips back to the text. She reads everything twice, including the last lines. "The excavation concluded in tragedy in September 1965 with the discovery of Professor D'Angelo's body in the nearby River Severn. A verdict of suicide was recorded." She woke quite suddenly, without having to retrace her steps up from her dream. An owl was hooting in the trees. Feeling foolish, as well as damp and stiff and chilled, Peggy returned down the moonlit track to the park gate and then the village hall. The remnant of her dream clung to her like a cobweb on her face. No matter how much she tried to brush it away, she could still feel it. Professor D'Angelo was leaning on the fence outside the hall, smoking the pipe he affected to go with his silver hair and his tweed jacket. "Peggy," he greeted her affably. "Had a nice walk?" She was opening her mouth to tell him to get stuffed, or maybe to acquiesce non-committally, she could never afterwards be sure, when a shadow dropped from the night sky. Bat-winged, black as coal holes and murder, it fell without sound to wrap lithe arms about D'Angelo's chest and throat. He yelled once in pure shock, and by the light of the porch bulb, Peggy saw a snaky tail whip up and jab him lightly under the ribs over and over again. God, she knew how horrible it was to be poked there. It might not actually harm, but it was an assault that tore the breath away. D'Angelo jerked with each stab and tried to scream, but he couldn't draw air into his lungs. Flailing spasmodically, he completely failed to fight off the four clutching limbs that gripped him tight. In a second, his thrashing carcass was hauled clear of the ground. In another, he was dangling over Peggy's head. Soon, Professor and Abductor were nothing but a single dark shape occluding the stars. And then he was gone. Peggy clutched the wooden railing for dear life, frozen in disbelief. It was all over so fast and so violently. She had no words for the midnight gargoyle she'd glimpsed only an outline. She couldn't name or explain what she'd just witnessed, even to herself. The front door opened, and Alice, the undergrad, stuck her head out. She looked surprised to see Peggy. "Is Rory out there?" she asked. Stunned, Peggy pointed toward the park. Her voice sounded like it belonged to a stranger. "He went off that way." What on earth for? Wrapped in her candlewick dressing gown, her arms tightly folded, Alice edged out onto the porch. He just came out to check the weather. We were talking about 4th century architecture. Where's he going?
I haven't, said Peggy, the faintest idea.
Gran? Nigel breaks the long silence humbly, dropping his voice so as not to disturb the kids in the next room.
I hope you don't mind me asking. Was Professor D'Angelo my grandfather?
For a long time, Peggy does not answer. She moves only to blink. Then at last she nods.
Yes.
And I knew. I carried Laurel with me down those steps into the cave. I took her into the presence. He was a real piece of work, that man. Very charming, but unscrupulous.
Nigel lets out a long breath that sounds like a sigh.
Conscience pricks Peggy. Your mother was nothing like that, of course. Don't think that, dear. She was... She shakes her head in wonder. She was quite extraordinary. Such an imagination.
Not like me, eh?
No. Nigel is quite the opposite to his mother. Staunchly prosaic. He never even reads novels, only non-fiction. Gifted, that's what the doctors called her. Even as a small child, she would tell the most incredible stories. Oh, sailing on a riverboat through a city with golden towers and riding her elephant to jungle palaces made of ivory in Chalcedony. I don't know where she even got that word from. It's not like she could have read it anywhere.
She can feel a wobble in her throat as she speaks.
She'd talk about sunsets, Nigel, and the way the moonlight made a path across the bay to the mountains beyond. Though she'd never seen the moon, or the sun. She must have heard it on the radio, I suppose. She never had any use of her sight, the doctors assured me.
Nigel puts his hand over hers and squeezes.
It's all right, Gran. Don't get upset. I don't want you thinking Laurel did what she did because she was a bad person or because she didn't love you. You aren't to think that. She was a beautiful, loving girl.
I know. Postnatal depression is just a thing, a terrible, random thing.
She said she couldn't sleep anymore. I think that was what broke her. I tried my best to help.
It's not your fault, Gran. Isn't it?
She swallows and sniffs back the tears. She was too good for this world. She wasn't meant for it. That's what they say, isn't it? That only the good die young.
He pats her hand, straining for jocularity.
Well, I hope that's not true, because you must have been terribly wicked in your day then.
She tries to smile, but has to turn her face away so he can't see the look in her eyes.
When the family depart at long last, she swallows 2 aspirin for her headache and takes herself off to bed with a warm cup of Ovaltine, a lifelong ritual that borders on addiction. Eustace slithers out from beneath the wardrobe and hops up to squat like a gargoyle on the counterpane. His face is an inscrutable darkness.
The first to identify the range of buildings behind the temple as an incubation, she muses out loud. It's all up there on the internet for the world to see. Millions and millions of people.
Smiling, she twists the cap off the little brown glass bottle, ignoring the twinges of arthritic pain, and spills the pills out into her palm.
I think I'm ready now, Eustace.
After swallowing all the sleeping pills one by one with the sips of the milky, malty drink to wash them down, she lies back against her pillows. Eustace looms forward over her supine form, not quite touching her, his horned head blocking out the evening light. She reaches up and touches him for the first time. His skin is oily beneath her fingers, and it flicks at her touch, almost as if he's shocked. He feels neither warm nor cold.
All in my head, she reminds herself, closing her weary eyes. Good boy, she whispers.
letting her hand fall back to rest upon her ribs. He waits, patient as ever, as she drifts off into a doze. At the end, she feels his hands slide round her, lifting her from the mattress. Maybe, she thinks, like Laurel, she'll be able to fly.